This is Zoe Dubkin. We are in the Solera space on Warren Street in Hudson, New York. It's June 15th, 2015, and I'm here with Vern Cross, who I will be interviewing as part of the Oral History Summer School Archives. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yep, my name is Vern Cross, born and raised in Hudson, New York, and that's who I am.
Can you tell me a little bit about where you come from?
I was born in Hudson. Like I said, my grandmother owned a bar on the corner of 2nd Street. We lived there for a while. When the high-rise, which is directly across the street, was built, we moved into the high-rise. I spent a majority of my life in the high-rise. Went to Hudson High School, went to all the schools here, and once I graduated, I moved on, went to Morris Brown in Atlanta, Georgia, and from there I came back for a little while, went to Columbia Green, and then I just started my life from there. I was probably gone from Hudson for about 12, 13 years. Like, as far as being a resident of Hudson, I would visit a lot because I was just in Pittsfield, Mass, but I was gone for a while. Still knew what was going on here. I moved to Alabama, to Birmingham, for 5 years. And then, unfortunately, my daughter became pregnant. And she called me and she was like, I want you to come back. So I've been back in Hudson ever since. I think my grandson's like 8 now. 7 or 8. So I've been here for like 8 or 9 years. I've been back to Hudson. That's it, as far as where I'm from. I'm from, like, old school Hudson. I would say that I'm from when it really took, like, a village to raise a child. And where we lived on a block where most of the houses on that block was owned by black people, like on Columbia Street. We used to have a lot of fun. Things were a lot different back then. I mean, you weren't allowed to go past 4th Street, and this is like on 3rd, so this is like, we couldn't even come up this far. Probably like at the corner down there, there's a Steiner's down there and a boys club. It's probably as far as you can go. Your parents wouldn't let you come up here. More, you know, white people up here, a little meaner, you know, police stations up here. It really was nothing for black kids to do up here, so we kind of maintained like 3rd and below. That's what they call it, 3rd and below. And we just had a lot of fun, did kid stuff, but there was a lot of mentors and like a lot of older guys that would really take you under their wing and teach you the ropes of, you know, how to be a man. Most of us grew up without fathers, so pretty much the streets was the only way that we had to survive. So the older guys out there, they saw potential in you. They kind of lead you in the right direction, tell you school first. And for me, it was kind of easy, but for a lot of people, they didn't make it. School was just, wasn't rewarding enough, but I didn't really have too much problems in school. A couple years, I had a couple problems. I think when I was in, like, 7th grade, I failed, like, English. And my mother was real strict, so summer school was in Catskill. And we didn't have a car, so she said, since you fail, it's your responsibility to get back and forth to summer school. And I had a bike, so I used to have to ride my 10-speed bike to summer school from Catskill, from here to Catskill. I would get up at 4 in the morning, and I'd ride because I could make it to the bridge. But once I got to the bridge, you know, that's when it got scary, and I was like, you know, I got to go on the bridge and all these trucks and stuff. So only I had one class over there. Class would start at 10 o'clock. I'd probably get across that bridge by 7:38, depending on how confident I felt that day. But then once class was over, I'd be scared to go back across the bridge. So I'd wait until like after like rush hour, and I would go back like maybe 9 o'clock. So my whole day was pretty much spent, you know, trying to get across the bridge and back across the bridge. But it taught me a valuable lesson. I never failed again, you know, and I passed flying colors. So it did teach me a lesson about, you know, being more responsible, and I'm in school to learn. So that was the only real time that I failed. other than that, I've been successful at pretty much anything that I tried to do. I mean, not to the level that I wanted to be at, but it's always been a comfort zone, should I say. When I have goals, I make reachable goals and unreachable goals purposely. A reachable goal is where I'm comfortable at, something that I know I can do, but it might take a little bit more than just regular effort. An unreachable goal is something that I gotta put 2,000% into, and it just keep me, it keeps me striving for the best. So that's part of the growing up in Hudson and the kind of people that I grew up with. There was this guy, man, and unfortunately he turned out, you know, drugs took control of him, but he probably was the best basketball player I ever seen in my life. You know, I was maybe 7, 6, 7. I lived in the building, and he would come to my house every Saturday and Sunday and pick me up to go play basketball. And he would beat me one-on-one every day, like all day. And I just couldn't realize, like, I told him, I'm not coming no more. Like, it makes no sense for me to come out here. You know, you don't let me score. He was like, I'm not supposed to let you score. He's like, but if you could score on me, you'll be able to score on anybody. And I don't know why, like, something that little just really, like, sat inside me. And I was like, well, you know, maybe. So I remember scoring on him. I scored 1 point, and I was, like, the happiest guy. But my confidence level rose to a point where I just felt like I could do anything, like, because he was the best in town. Like, he was the best. And at the time, I didn't really think about it. I just thought that he needed somebody to play with. But like I said, as I got older, I realized that he saw something in me, and he just wanted to make me better. So he just kept bringing me outside, and I kept playing, and he kept teaching me. But he would teach me by beating me, you know, like, so anything I ever got, I knew I had to work for it. That the people that I grew up with, they weren't going to give you anything. They were going to give you opportunity, but in order for you to have it, you got to go out there and earn it. And that's another thing that I could say that Hudson really taught me. And I was able to go on, and like, basketball pretty much, like, saved my life. Like, it stopped me from falling into the gaps of crime and drugs and stuff like that. It pretty much gave me a universal language that no matter what color you are, what sex you are, everybody understands it. And the better you are, the more they understand it. So I just got to a point where I just put everything into basketball, and I was able to go all over the place. I mean, I could just pull up in someone's town and just start playing basketball, and automatically I'd have numerous amount of friends. Can't call them friends now, but associates, people that wanted to be around me just for this gift that I think I was born with, but I probably wasn't born with the gift. I probably was just born with the will to fight. That's, I think it was. But basketball pretty much helped me throughout my whole life, even till to this day, you know, even to this day, like, no matter where I go, there's places I go and people just know me through basketball. But that was just like a stepping stone, you know. You have to be able to take that and be able to, you know, to make it work for you in other areas. And I think as I begin to go to other states, when I went to Massachusetts, the same way, I had a job, like, I had this job at, like, a boys' home. They had, like, boys' homes. Those are the jobs that everybody can get. Like, you get out of high school or college, and you just need to work. You just go work at a boys' home, or, like, right now it's, like, CNA, and those are, like, these entry-level jobs that everyone can get. But the thing about the boys' home was I grew up with kids like that, so I could relate to them a little bit more. But we started playing basketball, and we were, like, in this big gym playing. So I'm playing, and I'm kind of, like, I'm not showing off, but I really put a lot of work in to my craft. So this guy that worked there, he came up to me and was like, hey, you want to play on my team? And I'm like, huh? So I was like, all right. So they had this big tournament for all the jobs, because there was, like, maybe 5 or 6 jobs, houses on these campuses, and they had a big tournament. And the staff played each other, and I played on the team, you know. We killed them. Nobody had never seen me play before. They didn't know who I was, so we killed them. And he was like, I want you to play on this other team, and they play for money. And I'm like, I know, man, I live in Hudson. He was like, you're going to have to find a place to stay for the weekend over here. And I'm like, are you serious? He was like, yeah, like, I want you to play. So I kind of pushed it off for a little while. I was still young, you know, I still was like coming back to Hudson and partying all night. So my uncle, I have the same name as my uncle, both named Vern. I got a couple cousins named Vern. So my uncle played in this YMCA league, and it was a little short court, like 4-on-4 or something like that. So there was these black teams up there, and I came up there and I asked to play, and nobody would let me play. So my uncle had this great idea. He was like, since we have the same name, no one will know who played what game, so you can take my place. So we ended up like winning the whole thing. Like, and the court was so small that I didn't even have to go over to half court to shoot the basketball. So it was a regular size court for them, but the way that I had trained and worked so hard, it was like really easy. So I remember this one guy up there, he was like a legend. His name, I remember him because now we're friends. His name is Mark Coppo, this white guy that with really no talent, but he's the kind of guy that slept and ate basketball all the time. So he, we was playing against him, and I got mad at him, and I told my team to sit down on the court because it was like 30 seconds left. I was like, sit down. We're winning so high, we don't even have to play anymore. And he was upset with me. Like, you disrespected the game. You have no ethics and all this. And if you really want to play basketball with the real guys out here, you got to go to the boys' club. And this was this league this guy was telling me about. So after I won there, I went to the boys' club. And it was different, but I won a lot there. And the reason why I tell you this story, because like I was so proud of being from Hudson. Like everything I did, I made sure people knew I was from Hudson. Like I just felt like a pioneer. Like no matter where I go, like the next person that comes behind me, they're going to know Hudson was here. Like that's how I felt. And every day when I was away from Hudson, I always was playing basketball or anything I did, like thinking like, what if I was there? Because the competition was so great here. And I was like, when I go back there, I got to be better. Like I've been gone for 2 years. When I go back, I got to be 3 years better. So just the drive of Hudson, the old Hudson, it just really gave me that lift that I needed. And every time that I came home, it never disappointed me. To the point where I would come home and it'd be like Easter and I'd come home to visit my mom. And then one of the guys would be like, you got your sneakers? Let's play. Because like I was the talk of like being one of the best. So everybody wanted to play me. And the guy would be like, it's a friend of mine, good friend of mine. It's like, let's play. I was like, I didn't bring any sneakers. And sometimes I would purposely not bring sneakers. The next time he would see me, he was like, what size you wear? 13? I got a pair. Like it was just like he wanted to play me. Like he wanted to have what I had. And that always made me work harder, knowing that as soon as I come across that Hudson line and they know I'm here, they're coming. So I have a lot of respect for the old Hudson, like the different black organizations, like the CC Club and the Tainted Lady and 218. My grandmother owned a bar, like I said. So my grandmother was just like smooth. She cooked and we would deliver dinners to certain places. I remember being real young and I'd go, they had this place called The Hole and it was like a gambling hole and you would literally have to go downstairs, like down in the concrete and down into this hole. And I'd knock on the door and I would bring dinners to the guy that ran the hole. Then I remember they had an Italian spot over on Warren Street. I would go there and drop dinners off to him. So my grandma was connected with everybody, so it was like, no matter what I did or what we were doing as kids, like everybody knew who we were. So you really couldn't get into too much trouble because, you know, they tell your grandmother and my grandfather. I always joke with my mom, like my grandfather was like a pimp, but he wasn't like a pimp, but he just, every day he had a suit on. Like he dressed like really, really nice, crazy respectable. Everybody respected him. And like sometimes he would come to my grandmother's house when we sitting down to eat dinner. Like, even though like we lived in the ghetto, in the hood, like really in the hood, we didn't follow the same rules and like everybody else did. And I thought it was kind of whack because my mom would do crazy stuff. Like we would have family meetings. And I'm like, why the hell are we having family meetings? Like we live in a hood, nobody has family meetings. But we'd have family meetings and it was just a time where we could express ourselves. Like, I didn't like what you did yesterday. And it was just, but as you grow, it teaches you communication. It teaches you how to deal with anger without just, you know, blowing off steam. So it was a great idea. I had family meetings now. So even though I didn't like them then, but my grandmother would teach us, like, proper, no elbows on the table when you eat, like, how to use this fork, this spoon, whatever. My grandfather would come, and, it, you know, he would just sit down and just watch us as, you know, make sure that you ask nicely, don't reach over people's plates, stuff like that. And then at the end of dinner, he would just, we all call us up, and he's like, you did a good job, good manners. He give you money, you know, give you some money. So now it's like, oh man, you know, this is it. Like, these manners things, I could learn them. My high school is nothing, you know. So it was like, it was always initiative to be better, and you were rewarded, you know, when you were. And if you weren't, you weren't rewarded, but you were scolded to the point of where you knew that that type of behavior wasn't acceptable. So, and that's one of the things that I think old Hudson is missing, you know, nowadays. I'm in a good position. I mean, a lot of people respect me just because I learned as a young, I'll say a young boy, that people respect honesty. They respect truth. Like, you can be honest without hurting someone's feelings. They respect that. Like, if you, and I try to be as honest as possible without hurting people's feelings. I try not to hold back anything. If you make me upset, I'm saying, I really ain't like that. You know, that wasn't really nice, or so be it. And plus, in any black community, it's not about what you say, it's about what you do. You really have to lead by example. And I've always, like, everybody loves the kids, but I've been a kid. My mom worked for the state. And basically, my mom had me when she was 15, and then had my sister when she was 16. And then she graduated from high school and college. So, if you do the math and think about it, there's no way possible that she could raise us and be able to graduate from high school and college. So we lived with my grandmother for a large period of time while she was doing that. And that's one of the things that you don't have now, because the grandmothers are so much younger. But my grandmother took care of us so my mom could continue her journey. So, you know, but it put a lot of pressure on us as kids, because, you know, like, your mom had you at 15 and 16 and she graduated from high school and college. Like, you got to at least meet that or beat that. Like, that's just the way it is. She ended up working for the state. So, and when you work for the state at the time, it was in Albany. So we live in Hudson. So a lot of the stuff that we were able to do, we were under my grandmother's wing. And she was just old school. Like, I mean, so old school, where 4 o'clock in the morning, you get up. And school don't start till 8, but you're up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You bathe, whatever. You make your bed. Like, you would do all these things that just sound like, it seemed like the weirdest things to do. Like, Graham, like, come on. Like, we don't go to school till 8. Why are we up at 4? And but she was a cook, and a very good cook. So what she would do is, there was probably me and my sister, my cousin. There was this one lady. We had a white girl. Her name was Margaret. She lived with us because her mom was going to college. So she lived with us throughout the week, which was really cool. But Margaret was kind of, it was, she was funny, like, because she was white, but she lived with black people, but she just didn't know how to act. So my grandmother, like, would ask us each individually, what did you want for breakfast? And you could have anything you want. I mean, poached eggs, scrambled eggs. I mean, and she would individually make them. Like, I could have scramble, you could have poached, you could have pancakes. Like, she would do that. And one time, like, Margaret got to the table before us, and she had some cereal. So my sister got there next, and she's like, Graham, I think this milk is spoiled. But Margaret had ate the cereal with the spoiled milk because she was afraid to say something, like, thinking that something was going to go wrong, and my grandmother was going to have a heart attack. But that was the honesty thing about it. Like, my grandma wouldn't have a problem if you tell, like, Graham, this milk is spoiled. But to eat it, like, I'm not eating spoiled milk. But she was, Margaret was the best, and we all lived there, like, but 4 o'clock in the morning, I mean, and then when we got out of school, we get out of school, we change out our school clothes, put our play clothes on, we have to do our homework and our chores, go out, you eat dinner at 4:30. Now, eating dinner at 4:30 when you get out of school at 3 o'clock is kind of early, but she made great dinners and we cleaned that all up, and then you would have a snack. Now, a snack could be like a pie, a cake, like, I mean, my grandmother seriously cooked us. That's what she did for a living. So she would treat us like we would get treated the best. Like, so just growing up in that surroundings, that's all I know. Like, to this day, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And people always like, I don't know how you do it, but I mean, when you're younger and you're like in the fifth, sixth, seventh grade, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, your body is just like tuned to that. That's what you do. And I thank my grandmother for that, because like I can't even imagine sleeping all day. I couldn't imagine. I just feel like I need to be up doing something. And like I said, like the old Hudson offered that. We used to have this thing called the Black American Festival, when it used to really be the Black American Festival. Now they changed it to some cultural arts crap. I call it crap, multicultural arts crap. Only because our people fought for the segregation and to undo segregation. But the thing about it is, like, you have, like, if you look at these bigger festivals, you have, like, the Italian festival and the Puerto Rican festival. Like, it's their heritage. Like, you have to have that, because there's so many people that don't know, and you have to have it. And when you take the Black American festival and make it the cultural, multicultural, you lose out on your heritage. And we used to have it right on Columbia Street, and it was just like the best. It was like the best thing ever. And it was something that we all lived for, and it was ran by the CC Club. And I think the CC Club stood for like Color Citizens Club, and it was owned by Black people and ran by Black people. And another thing that they miss here in the New Hudson has changed so much, and now it's just it's sad almost. Like, I love my city, but it's bad. It's bad here. It's bad. And it's at a point in time where it's at a point in time where I don't even know who to blame. Like, you know, I don't know who to blame, but I just feel bad for the kids having to grow up like this. The Boys Club is a wreck. When I was younger, the Boys Club was everything. We used to have sleepovers at the Boys Club. We used to go to, like, Storytown. It's like a Riverside or a Great Escape. We used to do really good things at the Boys Club. Now they can't get 40 kids in there for a week. There's no programming. I mean, I don't know. I love my city. I always love Hudson. But I really wish that some of the younger kids could experience the things that we experienced. And now that I look at it, I think the generation between myself and my younger sister is where somebody dropped the ball at. Something happened, you know. And even me, like, I left. I left at a time where I thought it was better for me to go out there. I had to find my independence. Like, I had to find out what I was made of. Like, because in Hudson, everybody knew me. Like, everybody, like, I was that guy. And I was like, maybe I'm that guy because I was raised here. I need to go somewhere where nobody knows me and see if I can be that guy. To see if that's me. Am I that guy, or is it because I'm here? And going away really helped me establish that. It really helped me realize, like, no, it's not about being a guy. It's just that Hudson taught you these valuable, valuable lessons that no matter where you go, you're going to be all right. So I think Hudson for that all the time, even being away. Like, I was in Birmingham, like Birmingham, Alabama. Like, if you know anything about Birmingham, Birmingham, Alabama is like, if you watch the first 48, Birmingham, Alabama is on the first 48 all the time. I was in Birmingham. I lived in Birmingham. I lived in Atlanta. Like, I lived there, and not to the point where I was just like an occupant in a big city. Like, if I go there now, people will be like, oh, there goes Vern, you know, like with the same kind of love that I get from being here, or from when I go to Pittsville, or, you know, even when I go to Albany. It's just that, I don't know, something about this place that taught me just how to survive and how to treat people with respect, because respect deserves and desires respect. If I respect you, you have a choice but to respect me. And I think so. Hudson, boy, oof, great place. It was. Now it's just so many things, different things. And when I came back, I really didn't look into getting into all the stuff that I actually ended up getting into, but I just felt like I need to, like, and I just saw so many things wrong. So, like, my friend has a barbershop, and every Thursday, I would get a haircut, and I'd be the last one to get a haircut, and then he, you know, put the clothes sign on, and we just sit there and we talk, and it'd be a bunch of guys, and we talk about different things, and some guys would talk about, oh, I got to go to court for child support, and some guys talk about, oh, my landlord is doing this, and my landlord is doing that, and for the most part, like, I could help people with some of the things, because some of it is common sense, you know, like, you got to go to court for child support, okay. Well, just make sure you pay your child support and you won't have to go to court. But, you know, but a lot of it, you needed to, you know, have doors open for you. And my little brother has been a politician for, like, ever. I mean, ever since he was, like, I'm going to say 16 or 17 years old. I have a little brother named Quentin. He's my baby brother. So he was away. And when he came home, I told him about the barbershop. Like, I'm like, look, man, you know, I'm at this barbershop. I get 8-10 guys every Thursday. They look forward for us to be there. We talk sports, girls, everything. But there's some things that they need your help with. And I'm like, I need you to come to this barbershop just one time and just sit there. And if you can help, you can help. So he came to the barbershop. He left. He called me. He's like, hey, man, I got an idea. He's like, you know, we can start an organization that can help people. And I'm like, for real? I was like, yeah, like, we can do it. And I was like, all right. And it was kind of how the whole SBK really was created. SBK was created in a barbershop where it was just, my brother wasn't even there at the time. It was just guys going in there. And sometimes girls came and just talking about different things. And, like, it's hard being black in America. And I know everybody gets sick and tired of hearing that. But it is. And one of the places that is very hard, it's like when you become successful. Now, success means anything better than what you had the day before. I mean, and that's why I'm saying reachable goals. Like, if you worked at McDonald's, you know, this year, but next year, you know, you moved up and now maybe you're a waitress at Red Lobster where you get commission and you're making a lot more money. To me, that's a form of success. Like, you were able to take that struggle and you built on it. You didn't go backwards. You didn't maintain. You built on it. You're making more money, which gives you more opportunity, stuff like that. So I always said that if you want to make more money, you need more responsibility. And the only way to get more responsibility is to show yourself as being responsible. You have to be able to do things without being told. Like, even if you're working at McDonald's, someone shouldn't have to tell you to mop the floor. Just get up and mop the floor. People see that and like, oh, you know, he's kind of responsible. Let me give him something else. So that was the bigger thing with the guys that we were dealing with. They just couldn't see past the, oh, the man is holding me back. I don't have any opportunities and stuff like that. No, you have a billion opportunities. It's just what you do with them. Like, people have to start from the bottom. Like, a lot of people have started from the bottom. But when you start from the bottom and you continue to grow. So with the whole SBK thing, we were looking at it as a way to help young black men become leaders. Because what we found out, and this is true, is that society, for some reason, fears black men or black unity. And I'm not saying every individual person, but this is funny. Like, if you take four black guys and put them right out in front of this building, and the cops ride by two times, the third time they're going to stop and ask them, what are you doing? You take 20 white guys and put them in front of the same building and they'll never stop and they'll never ask them anything. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just like, oh, what are they up to? They could be up to something. Like, there's a bank up the street and, like, down in the high rise and on the lower sections of town, like, kids would hang out down there, you know, that's where they hung out. And the cops would come down and they made up this word and everybody knows what it is. They didn't make it up or they introduced it, loitering. You know, that's their word, they're loitering. So you're loitering. But if you ride up Warren Street, sitting on the DMV steps are a ton of white people and they're not loitering. This place is closed. It's across the street from the bank. It's closed. But that's not loitering. So when you deal with stuff like that, you have to start to think differently. And one thing my mom always taught us is that you have to be versatile. And it's important to be versatile. Like, you could be hood because you have to be able to maintain in a hood. But unless you plan on working, living, and always being in a hood, you have to be able to adapt to every situation. So, like, we would do stuff. Like, my mom was really cool. And when I look back, like I told you, I was really a, like, I used to think my mom was, like, a joke. Like, not a joke, but I'm like, you're the craziest mom because you make us do these crazy things. Like, she would literally give us money if we could think of an oxymoron. Like, if we could come in the house and think of an oxymoron, she would give us money. So, like, and we're like, you know, stupid. She'd give us different words to look up. But as I grew and the more I was, like, filtered out of my hood and into other situations, I could maintain. Because now I know what these words mean. I know how to, you know, react and act amongst people that don't look like me, you know. So I always thank my mom for that, for actually giving us things that we could use later on in life. Maybe because she realized it, but for working for the state, you know, you work at the state, there's a lot of different multicultural people there that you have to be able to get along with. So with SBK, we just wanted to try, you know, to take these kids and these young men that don't have fathers. Like I said, I never met my father, so I grew up without a father. And the streets, man, I tell you, they're so tempting. They're tempting. Like, they can really pull you in, and you need someone to, you know, to have that other side of that rope to keep you out of them. And we thought that SBK would be great for that, because we took people, like, people look at my friend, like I said, he has a barbershop, black guy, owned a barbershop for 8 years in Hudson successfully. That's a big deal. That's a big deal right there. And people could look at him and say, okay, you made it. How do I make it? Because there's this big misconception, and sometimes it's not a misconception, but the whole crab in the bucket theory. Yeah, that works, right, when you're in the ghetto. When you're in the ghetto. But if you get out and you're willing to help other people get out, a lot of people get help and they come out. And that's all we were saying, was like, this could be a perfect way for us to be able to help people. And one of the things, especially in a small community like this, is that you have to be able to show other black people that you know how to talk, and that just because this guy is white, it doesn't mean that you have to be afraid of him. Like, I think some black people are afraid to talk to white people because they maybe can't articulate their words well enough. When I lived in Alabama, I got a job, and it was at this pallet place. I used to just take jobs just to have money. Like, it was nothing mental, because the mental part of it was the easy part. Like, to me, sometimes it was fun for me just to do enough. I still have my goals, but I'm like, I could do this, no problem. So I took a job, like a pallet job, like doing pallets and stuff. And it was just machines and stuff. So I'm down south. Already, these people looking at me different because I have a different swagger. They tell me I talk like a white person. I'm fine with that. I'm like one of the blackest people in my city, man. What do you mean I talk like a white person? No, you're talking, all right, I'll live with it. So we were working, and then, like, the one machine didn't have, like, a cover guard on it, so to protect you. And I'm like, look, I called a guy over. Like, look, man, I can't work like this. You're going to have to either put something on there or put me on another machine. So when we go to break, they're like, oh, you're crazy. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, why was you talking to him like that? It's like, I don't know how you guys operate down here, but I'm telling you, I'm not working in a condition that's not safe. What can he do? The worst thing he can do is fire me. So what? I'll go find another job. And I was like, yeah. So, like, just speaking up. And it was, I mean, the guy knew it was wrong. And he closed the machine down. He reg-tagged it, and they got it fixed. But just standing up, like, to this white guy, and I really didn't stand up. I just said what I wasn't going to do. I had other options. And because of that, they looked at me like, all right, you know, yeah, he's a guy. Like, so now, and that's in itself, but up here it's the same way. Like, it's the same way. Sometimes you really have to just go toe-to-toe with some of these people that are in positions, because it's a known fact. And you don't realize it until you get older. It's not what you know. It's who you know. And if I know some of the same people as you know, it makes us even. Now the only thing that matters is how smart we are and what can we offer to the people that we know. Now, me being black, I can offer black people. You being white, well, we don't really match up when it comes to stuff like that. And I think that that's what happens, especially with this being a political town. You know, it's like, okay. And somehow they talked me into joining this housing authority. board for the building that I lived in, and I'm on that board, and they love me down there. But my thing is, like, I speak up, and the guy that's the executive director, whenever we communicate through email, he gets mad and he says, "Why does everything have to be in front of other people?" And I really just want to say to him, because they need to know that you are not the boss. They need to know that even though you are a boss, you have a boss. And you can't treat people this way. Like, some people, especially black people, they feel like there's nothing we can do. Why vote? It ain't gonna matter. Why this? It ain't gonna matter. So that's why SBK thought it was so important to take young black men and older black men and put them in position of power. Put them in the rooms with these people that's making these decisions so that they could be heard, like their community could be heard. And I think one of the best things that happened was when WGXC, her name is Lynn, she came to one of our meetings, because we used to have meetings in the barbershop, and she offered us a radio show. And for me, I did some DJing. Like I said, I just knew how to make money. So DJing was fun. It was craft. It was art. Plus, think about it. The DJ is like the most popular person for 2.5 hours because everybody wants him to play whatever they want to play. I mean, so, I was like, oh, man, this would be great. And then we just, like, formed a committee, and we just started doing radio. But I looked at it differently. I said, listen, you know, let's use this as a voice. Let's use this so that the people that can't be heard can be heard. Let's make this radio show so powerful that even the white people are going to want to listen to this radio show. But we messed up in the beginning. We didn't mess up, but we kept reminding people that we were black. And after a while, me and my co-host said, you know what? I think they know we're black. So let's stop talking about being black so much. Let's show that versatility. Like, if something happens where we need to put the stamp on it, let's do that. But let's show versatility so that it's right and wrong. Because when you come to right and wrong, there's no color in right and wrong. And I think that was the best thing that we decided to do, because that got us another radio show for the actual station, which was a longer show. We have a weekly show from 4 to 6. And I mean, I don't know if you can imagine, and if you get a chance to talk to people, like, our radio show is it for Hudson, because it's the only place where people can trust the people they're dealing with. The media itself has a way with twisting your words and stuff like that. Like, we had one of our biggest shows. This young girl, she's 18 years old. Her name is Denisha Roberts, and she has alopecia. And we didn't know what alopecia was. Nobody even knew she had it. So she had alopecia, and one day she just puts a picture on Facebook without any hair and wrote, like, this, like, it's a mesmerizing note saying the struggles that she's been through trying to live with this alopecia, but that she feels inside that, you know, I don't want to live with it no more. I just want to be me. And here I am. Love me or don't. So this is on Facebook. You know, Facebook is cool, you know. So now they're like, oh, you got to call Vern. You got to call KK. You got to get on the radio. So everybody is like, I'm at work. And, like, Facebook is going crazy and I'm trying to work. And I'm like, so he calls me. He's like, hey, we got to do this show. I'm like, all right. So, like, she did it on Monday. Our show aired on Wednesday. We got it together and we did a show, Denisha Roberts show. And people called in and they cried and they thanked us. And then we just looked at each other like, this is what, like, we're supposed to be doing. Like, we're supposed to, because if we don't have this radio, then she can't be heard. Like, Facebook, you know who hears about you on Facebook? Your friends. They already might be know. But on this radio, we can talk to everybody. And it's archived. Like, we can go back 10 years from now and say, look, you know, this is what happened. And another show that we did, a young lady took her life in our community, and it was sad. So we had to think about that. So first thing we had to do was, we know everybody in Hudson, everybody. And I went to her father and said, listen, you know, we have this radio show, you know that, and we would like your permission to be able to bring in a grief counselor to be able to help us learn how to grieve. You know, this is serious. But now you're talking on a level, this is what, quote unquote, white people do. Black people don't do this. You know, the people that we grew up around, they're like, holy shit. Like, for real? So we're doing so well with the radio. We have these outlets. We have these. I go to the lady. I said, listen, we need a grief counselor. They found us a grief counselor. She was from New Jersey. She couldn't make it up. So we Skyped her in. And we did a radio show. And, like, the radio show was supposed to be an hour. But it was just so touching and sad. It ended up, they let us go for 2 hours. But, again, another memorable moment that we had. And it was just like, it just built our bond and made it stronger. And because of SBK and because of the works that, you know, myself and my friend Kamal, we call him KK, Slay Diddy. We have my cousin is also on the show. Her name is 18 Wheeler. So we just brought in one other person on our other show. His name is Rainier. We just brought everybody together. And, like, for Mother's Day, we did a Mother's Day show. And so now our show is, like, going crazy. Little old Hudson, we call it Hud City, is everywhere because the radio streams. One thing that I did, because I was able to meet so many people traveling and stuff like that, they said, Vern, well, since you know so many people, have them listen to the show. Like, no problem, because every time they need something from me, I do the same thing. So now we have people listening in Alabama. We have people listening in Detroit. We have people listening in Hawaii. We have people listening in Kansas. Like, they really actually listening. So we had this great idea. Like, we're going to do a Mother's Day show. And what we're going to do is, like, we're going to call all these listeners that we know and have them do, like, a Mother's Day shout-out. And what we want them to do is to say their name, say where they're from, and do a Mother's Day shout-out. Well, this is amazing because now on our radio show, you have these people calling in and saying, hi, my name is so-and-so. I'm from Kansas. I just want to say I love your show. Happy Mother's Day. And it's like it's bringing this attention to Hudson that we never got before. Like, we never got it. So it on that side, it makes it seem like, okay, Hudson is doing this great thing. And we're doing these great things. And SBK is doing really good things. We put together a basketball tournament, and we thought it would be great to do a basketball tournament, and we'd have the younger kids play first because, you know, all parents love to see their kids play. But now, the problem was, in the school system at Hudson is really bad, from education to sports and everything. And what happens is a lot of politics in school, and we all know that. But the politics says little Johnny's going to play before Bobby because Johnny's father is on school board, but Johnny shouldn't be playing because he's not good enough. And let's think about this. Johnny's father's on a school board, so that means Johnny has money and other ways to get to college, but this is Bobby's only way out of here. But you're not playing him because you don't want to deal with Johnny's father. So we decided to do a basketball tournament for stuff like that. And what we did was we had the little kids play, but then some of the women was like, you know, SBK is really only focusing on men. What about the women? Because women are like that, you know. And we thought about it. We was like, you know what? True. So we had this great idea. First, we let the kids play. Then we let their mother play. And then we let the fathers play. Like, this is generational. Like, this is like, you're not going to get this in school. You're not going to get this anywhere else. And then one of the biggest problems for, like, our community is going to an event and being able to afford an event. You know, if you want to go to a Yankee game and you take your family of four, you're going to spend a ton of money. But I was like, listen, what we should do is we should make this so affordable and give them everything for nearly nothing because people will appreciate it. So basically, we charge $2 for adults, $1 for kids. And if a kid or an adult came to the door, we just let them in free if they didn't have the money. So right now, you're getting in good. So we had fried dough and hot dogs and stuff like that. Nothing on the menu was over $2. So now you can take your kids. You can have a good time. You can watch older guys like myself play against their sons. And some of the people like our age who haven't seen us play basketball in forever. Some of the people who never seen us play before. You got the younger group cheering for the younger group. And we made shirts. And it just became like a really, really good event. We do it yearly. I have to be honest. The reason why we decided to do it when we do it is because of the Pride Parade. Now, we believe that, I mean, come on, we're a minority, so how bad could we be if we say you can't do this or you can't do that? But the one thing that was really disturbing was in Hudson, the Pride Parade, I don't know if it is this year, but in the years before, the Pride Parade was the same day as Father's Day. And that's kind of like a punch in the gut, because there's guys walking through Hudson dressed as women. Now, if you have younger kids, you know, you don't. Personally, I don't want to see that. And I mean, they have every right to do it, but I didn't want to see it. And there was a lot of people that was angry about it. And I was more angry because I think I was being juvenile. I was like, there's no way in hell that the mothers will let them do it on Mother's Day. Because they won't. Like, it'd be impossible. Like, you can't even have anything on Mother's Day. Mother's Day have to be the whole day. That's it. And then, like, we have this thing called Flag Day. And Flag Day was just this week. There's no way the Elks are going to let the gay parade on the same day as the Elks. Like, but on Father's Day, I just didn't think it was right. But I didn't have a right to say anything. And, you know, when you get into a point where you don't, if you don't like something, you change it. So we put on an event. And it was nothing against their event. We didn't, like, bash their event, you know. We just put up a separate event. And it was that Saturday. Because the gay pride is a whole weekend. Like, the whole weekend, you can't go on Warren Street if you don't want to see that. Like, and like I said, I think for me, and I'm not afraid to say it, I just don't like to see men dressed as women flamboyantly like that. But I don't have a problem, but I don't want my 4-year-old son to see that. I don't want him to see that. So, I mean, already, we're already cut off in Hudson anyway. You know, you got Warren Street, and then you got the rest of Hudson. And if you go over a little bit to Union and stuff like that, that's okay. But Warren Street and everything over is the rest of Hudson. So now, with those parades going on, we decided to do our tournament the same day. Everybody was happy. You know, nobody's having a problem. Nobody's arguing. Nobody's fighting. So it just worked out to be a great event for us. And just for the record, my son is 4. He attends this daycare. It's called Bright Tights. And the lady that owns it is a lesbian. And she's a great teacher. I have to say that. She's a phenomenal teacher. She had my son for a while. His vernacular is great. His manners are great. You know, no matter how good the teacher is, you still have to have home training to back up the teaching. But she is a great teacher. So she asked if my son could march in the Pride Parade. And I was like, I don't think that's a good idea. But then his mom was like, you know, he really loves his teacher. The kids are going to be there. And I'm like, all right. And then the teacher assured me, she's like, well, we're going to go first. We're the first set to go off. And then once he's done with the parade, you guys can take him home. And I was like, okay, I got no problem with it. Because it's just the other side, you know, that's the... It's just hard, you know. And I mean, I'm the concerned dad, and I don't know if there's a label for me, but I just don't like seeing men dressed as women. I'm not cool with the Bruce Jenner thing. I'm just not. It's not like I just like it or whatever. I just don't want to see it, and I don't want my son to see it. I'm not trying to hide him from the truth, but I want him to be an older age, because, you know, he likes to mimic things. He's at that age, and there's a lot of questions that I don't think I could answer correctly or as a parent. So, but my son marches in that parade every year with his school. So that's why I wanted to make it clear that it's not something that we, you know, I feel a certain way about them. It's just that I have my beliefs, they have their beliefs, okay? So be it. But I just don't think that, you know, on Father's Day, that should be happening. So we put together this perfect tournament, and it works for us. It works, and the people look forward to it. And it's all through SBK and with help from Promise Neighborhood and different organizations. It's just, I don't know, it's great. And those are some of the good parts of Hudson. But then you have some of the bad parts. Like, I believe, like, because the Boys Club, as I said, the Boys Club is not being funded right and everything's wrong with it. But as a politician, if I vote for you, because I think that voting matters, and I vote every year. And I just like I'm at the point where I work at Ginsburg's, and I schedule all the inbound trucks to come in. So I'm in the office, like I don't really do any physical labor. So when it's voting time, like I'm even telling the white people, like, you have to vote And they're like, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you have to vote. Like, you have to. Like, this is your right. People fought for this right. And the thing about it is, if you don't vote and something happens, you can't complain about it because you did nothing. Like, most of the things that happen in our community is by vote. Like, the politicians vote for it. Don't you want somebody in there that's going to represent you and your family and do the best for you and your family? So, when you put a politician in office, especially if it's a black politician, you expect that politician to represent that black community. In Hudson, it wasn't happening. It wasn't. They would go in there, but they'd be bamboozled. Like, a lot of times there's an expression in the black community is, don't forget where you came from. And I think, I always try to figure out what the hell that meant. But I think I see what it means. It means like, when you get up here, don't forget that you were sent here to do a certain job. Don't start living like these people up here and forget about the people that you left there, who sent you there. So I remember SBK, we decided that the youth center was out of control. And like I said, there came a point in my life where I started to realize that I didn't need to tell people that I was black anymore. They already knew that. Everything that I did when I approached the situation was going to be right or wrong. If you're black and you did it and it's wrong, it's wrong. It doesn't matter. If you're white and you did it and it's white, it's right, you're right. So at the Boys Club at the time, not one of their staff members was certified in CPR. That can't be. Like, that can't be. And there's a black woman that's sitting on the committee and another black woman. Like, you cannot allow that. You can't. And if you do, that's a smack in my face. At the time, I don't live in a second ward. I live higher up. But I was there representing, and we got into a big fight. It was a little bad. Not for me, for her. I apologize to her. She's a great person. And I didn't realize what she had went through until afterwards. But I just said to her, like, you know, you sit here to do a job. You're not doing your job. And I think that what happens is that if black people don't call out black people, nothing will be done. Because if you're a politician and you're a white politician, you look at this black person as you represent the black people. But no, you don't. If you're not representing us, then you don't. You're just a stand-in. You might as well be white. So I'm not going to say I was mean to her. I was stern. And I hurt her feelings. Because when I started to be stern, she tried to get a little loud. And I didn't think that was necessary. I thought that she should just accept her punishment and be done with it. But she didn't think that was the way to go. And we're at a public forum. And again, when you go into a situation, you got to look at what you have to lose. Now, you're a politician. You're sitting as the chairman of this committee. Don't lose your composure because of something I said. Because people are going to see that. Now you have a weakness. Me, I could come in here, yell, scream, or whatever. They're just going to think I'm just an idiot. So what? I won't do that at work. So as long as I'm not putting myself in a situation that's going to hunt me back to work, I'm fine. I have nothing to lose here. As long as I stay within the guideline of being respectful. I don't call you no B-word. Don't swear at you. If I do, I can say hell or damn. But I thought it out clearly. So she was upset. The paper branded us as like militants or something. We had signs, you know, because we cared about our kids. But those things got fixed. They did. And she came to us later on, and I talked to her. And I think the one thing that bothered her, and this is why I had to apologize, because for the 6 years that she was in office, there was no SBK. There was no group that was unified to back her up. So she was really literally out there by herself. And nobody ever thought about that. Now, SBK is so strong right now. Like, we do, like, we go to court. Like, we go to court and we help people that go to court and say, listen, no, we're going to stand in for them. Oh, because one of the worst things to do is to go to court and not be able to speak the lingo. You lost. You accept things that you don't even know what you, like, what did I just do? So we do a lot of that. And She's a great person. And I mean, a great person. And I had to go and I had to apologize to her because I didn't look at it like that. And that's one thing that in Hudson we need, but throughout this whole country we need black unity. And if we ever figure out how to unite as one, we'd be so powerful. And I'm not talking about powerful to the point that you have to take over the world, but I'm talking about powerful to the point so that people could get what they deserve. And I'm not talking about handouts. I'm talking about, even if you look at, and I'll make this, I can make it clear. You look at women. There's no way that a woman doing the same job as a man should be paid less than a man. That's just not fair. If she's able to do the same exact job, she should get the same exact pay. So there's no way that a black man that can do that job should get paid less than a white man that's doing the same exact job with the same amount of history and the same amount of resume. It's right and wrong. But that still exists to this day. It still exists. And I just think that if we were to unite, we could get more people into powerful positions to make decisions. And that's where it all boils down to. Who's making the decisions on whether or not you get that apartment? Who's making the decision on whether or not you get the job? A lot of people say, well, you know what? Black people are lazy. People in general are lazy. But black people are lazy. And there's been many job opportunities. They just don't take them. Well, you know what? It starts with the school system. If the school is only passing 20% of the black people are only graduating, then how are the other 80% of these black people going to be able to survive? If they do not have basic, you know, English and math skills, they can't survive. They can't. So I'm looking at it and saying, in Hudson, we don't need to give black people jobs. We need to give black people training. They need to be trained. Because, like, my job that I have, I also, besides making scheduled appointments, the industry that I work in is very, very tricky. Basically, what happens is that we order food. The food comes, and they want to deliver it. But I charge them a fee to deliver the food that we order. Now, that sounds insane. This sounds insane if you think about it. It's like I order some food from you. You have a restaurant. You deliver my food, and I tell you, in order for you to bring it in my house, you have to pay me this much money. And you're going to look at me like, are you crazy? You ordered it. Like, why do I have to pay you? But the way that the corporations and everything are set up, because, you know, let's say, for example, we'll use Tyson. Tyson is here. Tyson's not bringing the food. They subbed it out to somebody else to bring it. So really, that's your fault between you and Tyson. So now you get a lot of angry people. Angry people that yell and swear and threaten. I got to be able to absorb that. I have to be able to say, I'm the boss. They can yell and scream all they want. His last name isn't Tyson. Your last name isn't General Mills. You have to do what you're told. But when someone's aggressive like that, and if they haven't had that training, their first response is snap off the hook. Like, I couldn't bring one of my friends that still live where they live at now, what I know they're not trained in anger management or how to control themselves, and put them in a great job like that and say, okay, and expect for him to do a good job, because he doesn't have the right resources. He doesn't. He's gonna flip. And that's what I think that Hudson needs. And that's what, you know, like I said, you know, SBK is doing. And even greater, you know, the Promise Neighborhood, Greater Promise Neighborhood. And there's another organization that's been here for a while, Operation Unite. And it's mostly black people that run Operation Unite. And I think I like them, but I just don't think I want to like them, but I don't. Here's the thing. You know how they use a phrase, token? Like, you're a token? And, like, I've been a token many a times. Please believe me. And I don't have a problem with it. I remember going to my boss's party. Now, I'm the only black person there. But I'm the only person there, really, from the job that hasn't known him forever. And he's introducing me to all these people. And I'm like, yes, I'm the token, but I don't have a problem with it. And that's to make them easy. But I'm here to learn. So sometimes if you're the token, so what? Make the best out of it. Because it's not like I'm a token and they're making me like wait on tables. No, he's giving me top, you know, VIP. I meet his mom. I meet his sisters. I say jokingly, yep, I'm the token. They're like, no, you're not. And they're asking me questions. Now I can learn. Like, these are the decision makers. These are the people that make the decisions. Now I get to rub elbows with them. So what? I'm okay with that. But here's the thing, if I'm in a situation and I can bring somebody else into that situation, I'm supposed to do that. Don't always come to me as a token, because after a while, if I did my job correctly, I should have moved up a little bit. I just spent a whole day with the boss is boss and the boss is boss. If I didn't make some kind of connection with these guys so I can make an investment, what was I doing there? Operation Unite, they're tokens. Because whenever Hudson needs something done and the white side needs a black person, they go to them. Like, look, we understand it. But can you give somebody else an opportunity? Like, you guys are set. Somebody else should have an opportunity. Like, really? Like, at the youth center, why would you hire a retired cop? He's retired from the police station as being a cop. He's retired from where I work at. He retired 3 times. Why would you hire him if he's retired 3 times? Like, he doesn't need it. The one job that you could give this young black man who has a kid, and even though it's a janitor's job, at a boys club, where he's going to see his father go to work and see his father try to provide for his family, that could make a whole lot of difference than giving this guy another job to supplement for him to be able to pay for whatever he's paying for or do whatever. That's the thing about it. And that's the society that we live here in Hudson. Because you know why? Because the right black people aren't in those rooms saying no. It's unacceptable. And at the end of the day, whether black people want to believe it or not, it all comes down to voting. It comes down to voting. And that's why I preach to these people so much, you have to vote. Because in the high rise, there's 145 people that live in that high rise. 145 people. Politicians don't see faces, they see numbers. And most of these people, especially in small cities like this, their father was a Democrat. Their grandfather was a Democrat. They already know. When they were born, they already know what they're going to do. But it's the minority, the people that thought that voting didn't matter, so you never voted, you never registered. Those are the people that win elections. If you look at how Obama was able to get into the office, it was the minorities, the people that no one knew was going to vote, that got him in. And that's why I just say, like, all you got to do is just get some powerful black people in there, and things will change. That's it. And that's where we are in Hudson. I think it's going good. You know, every time you go up, you fall down a little bit. That's just life. But I love Hudson. Like I said, I'm more in love with the old Hudson, and I try to bring it back, you know, as much as I can. Like a lot of the kids from every age limit, they really listen to me. They know that when I say something, that I'm only trying to help. Like I said, respect is everything. And the one thing that I know, that when I was 15 or 16, and the older guys used to try to, like, tell me to get lost, and you're just a kid, I hated that. So I don't do that. I make sure that I respect those kids. I make sure that I respect the 23-year-old. Because, you know, I know what he went through. I know what he's going through. And the last thing he wants to do is be disrespected. Respect him as a man. He maybe not be a man yet, and even though you know that, but at least talk to him as a man and give him that respect. It'll take you a long way. And then you'll be able to be on both sides. Like, I can be, like, if there's an incident and it's downtown, I could go down there and stop the incident. Not every incident. Some incidents, there's just nothing you can do about it. It's going to happen, and that's just the way it is. Or I don't have the time or the effort, and I have my own family to worry about to be getting involved in certain things. But for the most part, some things could be talked out. Like, come on, man, you know, really? And a lot of people look at you and say, okay, you have a great job. Now I want a great job. Can you help me get into your job? And the one thing that I always preach to all the people that ask me for work, I say, listen, you can use me as a reference. I don't have a problem with that. And guess what? Let's say you quit the first day. That's not going to hurt me. You want to know why? My work ethic will not change. I will be able to go to work and do my job. But you know what it will change? The next guy coming up. Because now my word doesn't mean anything. I'm not good with picking characters. So if you don't do it for me, do it for the next guy who really might need a job, who might be coming home from on parole and really want to change his life and start a family and be able to provide for his family and get out of the streets. Don't take away his chance, because in any job, it's like a relationship, really. If you try the relationship out and you don't like it and you go to the woman and say, look, I don't think we're going to make it, she'll respect you and say, okay, thank you, but won't have no hard feelings. But if you, you know, cheat on her or just leave and never come back, she's gonna harbor some bad feelings, and that's just how work is. You go to the job and you say, "Listen, boss, I tried it. I ain't cut out for it, man. Thank you for the opportunity. If you need me to finish the night out, I will. You know, maybe sometime when I grow up or something different, they'll respect that." And I said, you know, and that's what I try to explain to the guys. And for the most part, you know, some of them get it, some of them don't, you know. But like I said, I'm going to always be the worker that I am. I don't have a problem with showing you everything that I know. In this field, people don't like to show their secrets. I have a secret that you cannot take. My grandmother woke me up at 4 o'clock every morning. I will be up at the crack of dawn. My mother taught me words that didn't even mean nothing at the time. Like, my whole structure of concept is different. Unless you're on that level, you can have all these secrets, because they're never going to do you any good if you don't know how to put them together. It's a whole bunch of pieces to a puzzle. I just aligned them up right. So, and I mean, that helps me survive. It helps me maintain it. And I'm trying to do the best I can to raise my family here. It's hard. It's hard. You know, the school system is terrible. You know, it's really bad. You know, everything's a business. Everything. Like, everything from the jails to the school, you know, there's no concern. And, but you just got to keep fighting. Like, I'm ready to, there have been times where I've been ready to pack up and go. I thought about it, like, what about the people here? Like, maybe I was meant to come back here. Maybe this is what I was meant to do. So I just stick it out, and I just hope for the best. And that pretty much sums up me as far as the old me, as far as being here when I was younger and going away and then coming back. And like I said, I'm not done. I'm not done. One thing I can say, that one of the reasons why I really wanted to do this interview was just the radio aspect. Like, it's so major. And I just, like, I got so many, like, me and Kamal, KK, we have so many big dreams for this radio thing. And I just want people to know, like this how it started, this where it started at. And I know people appreciate it, and it's a good feeling that, you know, that we're able to help people and do stuff like that. And I just wanted that to make sure that was in the archives, because, like, it's really meaningful. Barbershop Talks is a pilot. Was a pilot. Like, there's places in Albany. There's this really, really, this lady, her name is, what's her name? She's in Albany. She's a speaker, and she's a great person. And she came down, and she heard about Barbershop Talks, and then she started doing it. Like, Alice Green. Her name is Alice Green. And Alice Green, anybody, just Google the name. She's, like, phenomenal. And she came to one of our seminars, like, one of our meetings, and she saw what we were doing, and she just went up to Albany and started doing Barbershop Talks. And, like, for us, like, we're like, that's everything. Like, here you have, like, a well-established woman in the fight that we fight, and she's taking ideas from us, you know. And so it just motivates us to just, like, yeah, we're on the right path. Like, it is. But like I said, it's like, people just have to realize, like, it's not black, it's not white, it's right and wrong. And it's always not going to equal up to that. But as long as you do that, you can stay focused, and some things don't bother you. Like racism, anyone that gets upset about racism hasn't really come to grips with the fact that there's racism. Like, at work, like, you know, it's hard to have conversations about race and stuff like that at work. But what I do is I switch it into a radio show, and I tell them, listen, you know, you guys are my guinea pigs so that I know how to act when I get on the radio. And I'll say crazy stuff to them, like, are you racist? And they're like, no, I'm not. I'm like, you're crazy. Everybody is. Like, and unfortunately, we are. And I'm like, all right, listen, here's a perfect example. And I know that I don't want to say it. But around 9/11 and after that, if you was on a plane and you seen a guy and he had a turban on, did you feel a certain way? Did it make you nervous? Did it? Like, yeah. Like, that's what it is. It's a learned hatred for whatever reason. That individual didn't do anything to you. Probably had nothing to do with what happened. But we grouped them. We can't help it. I said the better thing to do is to realize it and just try to be better people and treat people accordingly. When I was down south, I love the white people down south, because they'll tell you to your face, I don't like your kind. Hey, I respect that. I'll get out the way. But up north, you know, you could be working with a guy. He could be like, you know, you guys share like a cubicle, and then you, next thing you know, he's on Facebook using the N-word and all this, and you're like, thought this guy was my friend. No, he just knew how to mask it right. So those are some of the things, and I think that the more, if we can get the younger generation to understand that, you know, when someone calls you the N-word, so what? Like, it's just a word. Like, it's not something to lose your cool over. My friend Kamal, he always says that. Like, what am I supposed to die now that you call me the N-word? Like, come on, what do you expect for someone to do when they're upset with you? Say nice things? Like, so all the racial stuff and with everything that's going on with the police, it is really hard being black with the police. It is. I mean, there's been many a times, like, I've been stopped, and I remember being in cars, and they take you out and put you on the curb and take your shoes off, take your socks off. Not too long ago, I was walking home, and it was an accident, and I was trying to find out who it was, and someone that was involved in the accident was someone close to me, and the officer started talking crap to me, right? So now I can handle it a little different because I'm not the same guy from before. Like I said, if I know powerful people, then you're just a pawn. You're in my way, right? So either treat me with respect, or go ahead. If you think you want to detain me, you do that. But this is not going to look good for you at the end of the day. Like, so, you know, the officer is like, leave. I'm like, I don't need to leave. I'm not doing anything to you. I'm here. I'm a concerned citizen, and I can be here. I'm not in the way, whatever. So he started raising his voice. I don't know why you're yelling. I'm like, you're not scaring me. I don't know why you're yelling. So then his, like, commander chief or whatever the guy was, he came by. And I was like, this is the way that you guys treat law-abiding citizens, because I didn't do anything wrong. And he recognized me. And he's like, come here, let me talk to you. And I was like, what? He's like, you know, he's just a little stirred up. And like that, I was like, well, he needs to apologize. Or something needs to happen. Because already in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, now I have the power of the pen. Like, being a part of SBK, before, if I say boo, it's just boo. But now if I say boo, it's a big boo. Because all anyone needs is for someone that they trust and believe in to experience the same thing that they experience, and then it's a problem. He apologized, and then I was okay with it, but I'm thinking, what if this would have been somebody else? What if this would have been somebody else that they didn't recognize? How would he have been treated? And I just think that police should be held to a higher standard, and if you're not cut out for the job, then don't take it. Don't take it. You know, you need more training? Yeah, that's fine. Just don't take the job. Because they harass black people. I'm sure they harass white people too, of course. You know, but they really do. And I mean, I remember, like, even, like, the stereotypes are so great. Like, you know, like, I could walk, like, from the building and come up the street. And, like, undercover cops who, like, out to buy drugs are stopping you when you're walking, minding your business. Hey, you know where I can buy drugs? Like, why would you try to entrap someone? Like, I understand you got a job to do, but it ain't like I'm looking for you. I'm walking. I'm minding my business. I don't see them doing that out there in Greenport or all them other places. They don't do that. So it's hard, you know, but it's a fact of life. Hey, if you don't want to get stopped like that, wear different clothes, I guess. But I should be able to wear whatever I want and be comfortable, you know. But it's just more work for us to do. That's all. Hudson, like I said, this Hudson is bad, but there's room for growth, but we need black unity. And the bigger thing, and this is a big, it's so funny, like when they had the Trayvon Martin and all these incidents with the police and stuff like that, you know, they did a lot of marching, and I was able to march. And when you get to the marching, it's more white people than black people. So people are mad. Like, why is there more white people than black people? I'm like, wait a minute. We need more white people than black people. Because white people don't listen to black people, but they listen to white people. You know why? Because these are the people that know the people that they know. Like, it's important for us to have white people with us to make a statement. Because our statement means nothing without convincing someone else that it's a problem. And I think that's the bigger thing. And that's why I was so glad when me and my buddy, like I said, we decided that it wasn't about white or black, it's about right or wrong. And as we continue to grow, we see that all the time. Because, like, Sarah's at all the marches. Like, Sarah's, like, one of the coolest people ever. Like, we met Sarah through the radio, and, like, she, like, walked us along because we were, like, nervous because, like, you know, FCC has all these rules. You can't say this, you can't say that. And, like, some of the people that we were going to be interviewing, like, they don't care. They curse. They, you know. So, like, the first 6 months, we pre-recorded our shows at my house. We wouldn't do them live because we were afraid. But then it came to a point in time where we just said, you know what, we got to do it. And we did it. And every now and then you'll get somebody that, you know, drop the S word and you tell them, like, come on, man, you can't swear. Or, you know, they're talking and say the N word, like, listen, one more time, I'm going to hang up. You can't say that. Okay, I'm sorry. And then they, you know, they straightened it up. But for the most part, you know, but Sarah was the one that really walked us through and held our hand. And like training wheels, this one day she just took training wheels off and said, go. And she's one of our biggest supporters. And like I said, you know, that's my new motto. It's not about black or white. It's about right or wrong, you know. So that's it. Hope that's enough.
No. Is there anyone's name you want to put on the record? Your grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother. Her name is Bernie Styles. My mom, like I said, probably did an interview. Her name is Toni Kross. And my mom, like, just from, after you listen to this, you will see that me and my brothers and sisters, I have a sister named Sissy and a sister named Kaya, India, Owen, and Quentin. But you can just tell that we're a lot different, but we are the same. But we're a lot different than a lot of people. And people just think, like, we were born this way. You know, my mom was a good mom. She was a really good mom. She just gave us a lot of tools for us to be able to make it in the world. And we all, like, look at it, and we all have those same gifts and those same tools that we use. So my mom, for sure. And then my grandfather, Edward Cross, he was a G, OG. And it was very important that I had to carry myself like a man, even when I was a boy, or he'd have a problem with it. So, yeah, those are some of the people that really helped me. And like I said, with basketball, there's a guy, like I said, his name is Steve Weathersby. Anybody from Hudson know these names that I'm mentioning. Steve Weathersby, Gary Dempsey, Lenny and Lyle Hughes, and one guy from Catskill, Daryl Jordan. He really taught me a lot. And this guy used to be the chief of police, and I think I learned so much from him, but his name is Ellis Richardson. And I really didn't know why those guys, or why all those other guys really liked me, but then I figured it out. They just saw something in me, and they continue to tutor me. Like, when I see them, they always tell me how proud they are of what I'm doing now and how not to stop, you know. And that's huge, man. I'm a grown man. I got kids, and my daughter have kids. And when you have these guys that still look out for you and make sure that you're staying straight and narrow path, like, I just feel like I was blessed to be able to be around such really great influences and stuff like that. So that's about it.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. All right. well, yeah, so we're here in Hudson, and yeah, this is Vern Cross. Thank you.
You're welcome.